Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Donald Primore Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Costas. What's up, friends? I hope you're doing great out there today. I'm super excited because this afternoon I get to hang out with some good friends of mine. I was recently on the Dental Unfiltered podcast with Andrew Vallo and Matt Brown. We did a crossover episode. So the focus was on me, and they were asking me all kinds of really good questions. Today, I get to flip the script, and they are on my podcast, and we are going to be interviewing Andrew and Matt about their kind of genesis with the podcast, their history in dentistry, their entrepreneurial journey, a little bit about their personal lives. So I'm super excited. A little bit about Andrew. Andrew is a 2016 grad of The Ohio State University. And is a trailblazer in dental entrepreneurship. He's opened four dental startups in just over 2 years, and he prioritizes rapid growth, attracting up to 250 plus new patients monthly in a single office. As co-host of the Dental Unfiltered podcast, he shares insights and industry trends on the regular. And Matt Brown is a military veteran and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt and co-host of the podcast. He's a partner at Energize Dental Marketing, and his expertise complements Dr. Vallo's creating a dynamic energy that inspires dental professionals to navigate the complexities of modern dentistry and entrepreneurship. Fellas, what is happening? Good to see you both today.
What's up, Mark?
Good to be on, Mark.
Yes, yes. All right, so Andrew, you have upped your mic game significantly. That's a very expensive mic. I think that's a Shure. Is that a Shure?
I honestly have no idea.
Okay. I bought him the mic for our podcast. I'm pretty sure it's a Shure though.
Matt sent me this whole setup, so yeah.
As a beautiful mic, and you sound silky smooth. Let me just say, finally, you sound like a podcaster. You have been a podcaster, but now you sound like one, which is very important. So congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations. Thanks, man, on making that important step. Hey guys, first of all, let me start with you, Dr. Andrew. I want to hear a little bit about your journey. You graduated, you are a mere pup. You graduated about 7 years ago. And you've been able to do a lot in the profession of dentistry. It's funny, interestingly enough, the 7 year mark for me, I had a small group of dental practices as well. And for me, the 7 year mark really just kind of stands out in my head because that was a breaking point for me. I was doing everything incorrectly. Although I had six dental practices, I did not set them up correctly. I was not a good delegator. I was not a good leader. I had, you know, six practices, 50 employees. I was working 80-hour weeks, putting a strain on my personal relationships. The people at the practice didn't like me very much. Although the practices were very successful, I was not a successful human just because of the way that I set up my life. I would love to hear more because you are at that stage right now, the 7 year mark. You're experiencing rapid growth. How's been your journey so far? And I hope, because you're a member of DSI, that you've set your life up a little bit differently than I did the first 7 years.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey for sure, Mark. When I first graduated, I did public health for the first 3 years. So I was commuting like an hour and a half each way, working 5 days a week. I had a little Saturday gig, like every other Saturday at a DSO. So that was kind of the start of my journey. When I decided to move to Florida, I was actually going to buy a practice. So I wasn't even going to go the startup route. I actually had everything ready to go, had the LOI signed. We were in like the 11th hour. Had already sold our house up in Ohio, and then all of a sudden the sellers got cold feet and backed out. So, my wife looked at me and she's like, what are we going to do? And I said, well, you know, we're moving to Florida, you know, we're going to figure it out. We'll get a job, you know, whatever. So we moved down here. I worked as an associate for a little bit. But at that point I still knew I wanted to go into ownership. That was always the ultimate goal. So, I decided at that point I wanted to, take things into my own hands. So I decided to do a startup. I worked with Ideal Practices on the first startup. And it took almost 2 years. I mean, it can take longer than you expect trying to find the right commercial real estate and do a build out and, you know, get everything run, like get through all of the permitting and all that stuff. So I'm finding that out with startups number three and four right now. I mean, we've had some major construction delays. So I think four is probably the magic number. After this, I think if we grow the group, it's going to be acquisitions moving forward. So
got it. Do you have, an expansion slash scaling strategy? Did you put these strategically according to demographics, or was this just were these locations kind of opportunistic? Did you stumble into them? How did you select the locations?
So we ran some demographic reports, to try to find a good area. We live in an area outside Tampa, and I wasn't planning to put my first practice right where I lived. I didn't really think I wanted to run into patients in the grocery store and things like that. But it just so happened that the area we're in was a pretty good area. And I found that's where I found the commercial real estate after 6 months of looking. So we ended up going into that demographic. My practice is less than 2 miles from my house. So, when I go on runs, I run by the practice and things like that. At this point, I'm only seeing patients 2 days a week too. So, it's a little bit less important, but it's still nice to have that quick commute. The second practice was an implant practice. So, my first practice is general. The second one was implant. That one's about 5 miles from the first practice. So they refer pretty nicely to each other. The two new practices, we're actually putting them both in the same building. So it's a ground up build to suit. It's just over 4,000 square feet. And basically we have some shared spaces. So there's like a shared sterilization, a shared like waiting area. We call it patient lounge. And then like there's the two kind of sides of the office. That's about 45, 50 minutes. That's like the other side of Tampa. So it's a whole nother, market, a whole nother demographic we'll capture over there.
What's the concept there? If there are two practices side by side, is one a specialty practice and one a general practice? How does that work?
Yep. Yeah. So we basically mirrored the first two practices. So we've got like the general cosmetic practice, and then we've got the implant practice. So we basically, built two different brands. We've got the dental boutique brand, which is the general cosmetic side. We do a lot of Invisalign there too. And then we've got the implant office. It's no hygiene. There's one doctor usually. And basically we focus on full arch cases. So we're doing a lot of snap-ins, a lot of hybrids, things like that.
Awesome. Awesome. So how's the journey been so far?
It's been good. It's been exciting. I mean, we opened the first startup just a little over 2.5 years ago. So it hasn't been a very long time that all this has happened. But I've been trying to be intentional. I've talked to you before. I think being in DSI has been very helpful, because when I first opened the first couple startups, I really had no systems, no organization. All I was focused on was getting as many new patients in as possible, hitting production targets, things like that. And we have been way more focused on systems, delegation, things like that lately. And that has taken some stress off my plate. But I think anytime that you want to grow quickly, when you want to scale fast, I mean, there is definitely some level of stress involved. When you're on our podcast, we talked about having seasons to your career. And I think, I'm still in that grind mode season for sure. No matter how many great team members and leaders I have, there's still a lot of work that goes into trying to grow this fast. So
love it. Okay. So what does your org chart look like? Do you have an executive level team yet, or are you just kind of wearing a bunch of hats right now still?
No, we don't have an executive team, but I have office managers at each office. And so, I think just having that was like the first step for sure. I mean, for instance, today we unfortunately had to let go of an employee, and having that office manager in there to deal with some of those HR issues has definitely taken a big strain off my plate. Mm-hmm. The plan for next year is that we're going to actually try to acquire two more practices. So I think once we get to six practices, the plan is to start to make a C-level team, start to get maybe some regional managers or operations managers kind of in play to take some more things off my plate as well.
Well, let's talk financing then. If you are expanding at this clip, I'd imagine that you've bumped up against some sort of a ceiling with some traditional lenders. How are you getting creative and continuing to push the envelope for more and more locations?
Yeah. So, when I went to open startups number 3 and 4, I talked to probably about 12 different lenders. And 11 of them basically said, "Hey, your numbers are great, but there's no way we can make this work." Fortunately, the 12th lender was Huntington Bank, and Huntington Bank has a growth program. And I've been able to work with them to continue to expand our organization. they had to take over all of our lending. So basically we rolled the other loans into, you know, one loan with Huntington. And they're going to continue to fund us to grow as long as our numbers continue to make sense for them.
Awesome. Okay. I'll be back to you, Dr. Andrew. I want to talk to Matt for a little bit. Matt, how you doing, buddy?
What's up, Mark? How are you?
I'm doing great. I love your bio. Military veteran and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. Those are two things that I'm very, very interested in and I respect very much. I want to hear just your story, your backstory, how you got involved with dental marketing and how you ended up connecting with Dr. Vallow on this project.
So it's crazy. I'm actually not a dental professional or a marketer. Like, this whole thing was organic and happened on accident. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was pretty big in the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu martial arts space. And I worked with a company that was a big marketing firm in martial arts, and I advised and spoke at trade shows and basically trained on that side a little bit. And my uncle was a dentist and he was complaining about his marketing. I was like, hey, will you help me? I was like, hey man, I don't do teeth. And he goes, come on, just help me out. You know more about marketing than I do. And I helped him. And then I helped another doc, and the other doc happened to be a client of Ideal Practices and Steven and Stacy and those guys. And we took a practice from like 30,000 a month in collections to like 180, like very rapidly. And Steven basically was like, how are you doing this? Show it to me. And I showed him kind of our strategy and our software and what we do. And Steven's like, do you want more practices? I was like, I really didn't intend to be in dental. And then we woke up now 4 years later, hundreds of practices later, and we have a dental company. It was never intended to happen. I actually like my home in dental a lot. It's been fun to learn a new industry and be so young in it. Like being 4 years, like every time I'm on with an office manager, I'm learning something pretty cool. Yeah. And actually, Andrew was an Ideal client, and Andrew got pitched by us through Ideal, picked a different marketing company, and they came back around, I think, and they got picked us back up again. And we've been together maybe 3 years now, through the growth of his practice, maybe four. And we just always connected well, the way we thought was really the same. And one day we were like, both of us kind of had a problem with the dental podcast that like they always turned into infomercials for someone's product.
Yeah,
like everyone did. And we were like, I learned dental by listening to podcasts. That's mm-hmm. how I taught myself. And we both were just kind of like, let's just do a podcast where we're not taking sponsors at all. Mm-hmm. And let's just talk about subjects we think are important. And let's just pick the guests based on impactfulness to the dentist, not someone buying a sponsorship. Mm-hmm. And we kind of held true to that. Even me, we actually never even mentioned my own company's name ever on the podcast as a rule. Cool. We just don't. Yeah, we just don't. Like, I could easily turn that as infomercial for my own income real easily, but I want it to really be a truly selfless production, mm-hmm. just for what we and Andrew, because I'm on the front lines as far as talking to dentists that are struggling every day, all day, mm-hmm. and they come to us for help. And then he's actually on the front lines doing dentistry. I thought those two unique point of views had a high value for dentists. So I never intended to be here. It was never, my background is very different than what I do. I worked covert surveillance in our special operations community. I was a hand-to-hand combat instructor in special operations. This is not where I thought I was ever going to be, but I've actually really enjoyed it.
That's cool. What branch of the service were you in, Matt?
I was in the Army for 7 years. I was on Fort Bragg. And I loved every minute of it. I got retired from a parachute accident, but I miss it. I loved every minute of being in the military.
Did you become proficient at martial arts when you were in the Army, or did you go into the Army as an advanced level combat?
I went into the Army advanced. So I had competed and trained for almost 3 years before I entered the Army. Mm-hmm. And at the time back then, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was starting to find its way into our special operations community. Mm-hmm. And I got to Fort Bragg and I knew that I wanted to teach hand-to-hand combat, but there's no real way to make it there from the street. You have to figure it out and navigate it. Mm-hmm. The year I left for the military, there was an organization called NAGA. At one point in time, they were the big organization in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I was ranked like top 10 in the world in my weight class and my belt rank. And I got to Bragg, everyone rolls in the special operations community. I just found where all these guys trained. I started spending time with them. And I was a private parachute rigger. And one day this Green Beret was like, hey man, do you have a job? And I was like, yeah, I'm a parachute rigger on base. He goes, no, do you want a real job? You can come teach combatives for us and be a hand-to-hand combat instructor. And I got lucky. and ended up teaching Green Berets and stuff, hand-to-hand combat for most of my time on Bragg. So I spent like 80% of my day every day in a mat room wearing fight shorts, beating up Green Berets. And it was the greatest point of my life ever.
Amazing. Amazing. When did you
Yeah.
retire?
Tooth, I had a pair. So I went to work for an agency up in the Maryland, Virginia area, and I left active duty. With leaving military service totally, I would say 2015-ish, leaving active duty and going to that agency to be a kind of element up there, about 2 or 3 years before that. So I kind of had a weird transition there.
Cool. Cool. So what were you doing for the combative community from a marketing perspective?
So, kind of like in dental, there's a serious deficiency in sales ability. So, dentists have a kind of a challenge that you guys are engineer minded, sometimes tend to be introverts, and chairside manner in developing sales abilities is a challenge. On the other side, in martial arts, it's actually the same. Professional martial artists actually fall in the same boat. They're very analytical. They tend to actually be introverts. They're probably geeks in high school, right? And they actually find their confidence through martial arts, but they actually never get confidence selling. The thing I taught on that side was new student experience and maintaining a good student experience and selling. And then when I got over to dental, I never intended to be a sales trainer in dental or even have sales training at Energize, and we do. I was just out of practice one day. I was struggling. I said, "Can I have the chart and can I try to talk to the patient?" And they're like, "Sure." And I ended up selling like $20,000 in treatment because I started taking all the patients that day. And I never had formal training case presentation. I just kind of created my own process. And it was kind of the same thing. I just kind of like mirrored what I did in martial arts to get the person to accept treatment and say yes. It is harder because they have, I think both of them have an element of fear. They're scared of getting hurt on the martial arts mats and they're scared of dentists. So I had to overcome fear on both sides. But that's really kind of how it happened. It was just like I taught sales and new student experience over here, and it became new patient experience and case acceptance over here.
Got it. Awesome. Thanks for that background. All right, back to you, Andrew. So, tell me about kind of what your overall vision is for your organization. How rapidly do you want to scale? What's the end product look like? If you were to fast forward, 15, 20 years when you're ready to transition out of your current profession.
Yeah, so I think that this new office where we're combining both brands under one roof, that's kind of a trial for us. So, we're not quite sure how it's going to work. I had to convince Huntington that this was, a good idea, and we actually, formed a DSO to put both brands under. I have a partner on the implant side, so he's a periodontist. So he's kind of our clinical director. Believe it or not, I actually don't place dental implants myself. So I own a dental implant office, but I don't place implants. We have super GPs in there that are doing that. Kind of the thought process was like, hey, like let's combine forces, let's get both brands under one roof. And then if this works out where we can conserve space, then we can continue to open these kind of 2-for-1 offices. So that was kind of the first idea. As I mentioned, we kind of ran in some major construction delays. So we were supposed to open this next office in June, and it's December, and we're fighting to try to get our CO permit before the end of the year. So that's been fun trying to talk with the, accountants and all that about how we can try to make things work here. But if things continue, along this trend, we may try to find larger offices that we can buy and kind of add that implant component, to the office as well. But it is a little bit of trial by error right now because this is something new for us. We do want to continue to grow, and my goal for 2024 is we want to acquire at least two practices that year. That's kind of what we're thinking right now. Obviously, if we're going to continue to expand beyond that, we do have to get a bigger leadership team. We're probably going to have to internalize more things because we're outsourcing a lot right now. Things like, call centers and insurance verification and items like that. Whereas as you get to the point of a larger group, it often makes sense to build that infrastructure. But obviously there's also, the costs involved. So you have to kind of weigh all those as you grow.
Yeah, cool. So, tell me a little bit more about the concept. Are the associates often hopping from side to side? So, will you get a general doc that's doing fillings one day and then dropping implants for an all on X the next, or do they stick to their own side and just kind of specialize?
No, at this point in time, they don't. So we have, you know, separate teams for each, you know, office. We may have a little bit of personnel that go back and forth a little bit at the new office since it's in the same location. But essentially we're looking for associate docs that want to do everything except implants on the general side. And then we're looking for docs that have really, you know, specialized in these implant procedures, and they're doing everything. They're doing the surgeries, they're placing the implants, they're doing sinus lifts if needed. They're, you know, restoring the prosthesis and all that. On the general side, you know, we try to keep pretty much everything in house. So we're doing molar endo there, we're doing crown and bridge, we're doing Invisalign, veneers, smile makeovers, you know, things like that. So.
Yeah. Cool. So you were able to quite rapidly decrease your clinical chair time. Have you experienced what so many kind of CEO leaning practitioners have experienced, where there's definitely more cash flow as a 4-day week clinician than there is as you know, an upstart CEO for a multiple practice group?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mark. I think that's something that a lot of dentists don't think about. You know, they think, hey, I'm going to grow my group, I'm going to cut back, and all of a sudden I'm going to make a bunch more money. It doesn't really necessarily work that way. So we're trying to continue to grow the group, grow the profitability, grow our margins so that it can replace, you know, income as a dentist. But there's days where you think about that, like, man, if I would have just focused on my one office, you know, worked full time, maybe brought in an associate to work with me, you can often make more money than you can being a multi-practice owner. And I think often that's even lost on, you know, some of our associates and things like that. At the same time, I mean, it was the right move for me, and I knew it was. And unfortunately, while I still enjoy clinical dentistry, it's become more stressful because the 2 days a week that I'm there. And so when I just, I guess for background reference, when I first opened the startup, we started at 3 days a week. And I decided at that point that I didn't want to ever go back over 3 days a week. So as soon as we grew to the point where we could, I added a 1 day a week associate. They were doing Fridays. And then as soon as we grew beyond that point, I brought in a full-time associate and cut myself down to 2 days a week. But those 2 days that I'm there, you know, when you're just a solo practice owner, there's a lot on your mind already. You're dealing with, you know, team issues, you're dealing with HR, payroll, marketing, all that other stuff. But when you've got other offices open, you've got other offices that you're trying to open, you know, between every single patient I see, there's emails I have to answer. There's things I got to do. I'm stressed out about things that I'm not getting done that are urgent that I need to get done. So, you know, I used to never get stressed out doing dentistry. Like, that was always like kind of, you know, the easy part of it. But those are my most stressful days of the week because I'm trying to be both a dentist and this, you know, multi-business owner CEO. So I think there is part of me that will see relief, you know, eventually when I do step back from the chair completely, but.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can relate to that.
Oh, but, dude. Yeah. I can relate to that. And, you know, to my original question, I remember the first time, you know, I went from, you know, a 6 day a week doc doing, I mean, I was a general dentist. So I was doing, you know, $5,000 a day, five to $7,000 a day, you know, 6 days a week. So I was having good weeks, but I was working my ass off, but the paychecks were really nice. Right. Working out of several practices, paychecks were really nice. And I remember the first time I'm like, you know what, I'm going to convert this into more of a CEO position, and I'm going to start peeling back some of my clinical hours. I was shocked at how big of a pay cut I had to take in order to run these multiple practices. Even, you know, when I got to five or six practices, you know, if you limit your clinical time, until those businesses are really mature and they're black belt level practices, spinning off 25% EBITDA, until that happens, the paychecks are pretty skinny in comparison to what we can expect as a highly productive dental practitioner.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, to your point, a lot of people are shocked by that transition. Like, holy cow, like, this is below my associate salary my first year out. It's like, well, yeah, there you go. Because dentistry, for better or for worse, is an extremely lucrative profession. And you can run a very, very sloppy dental practice and a sloppy operation. But as long as you have production, you're always going to make that 30%. And that's a really, really nice living. So I often say, you know, dental practice ownership is not for everybody. Not everybody could be a strong leader. not everybody has the business savviness or even the interest to learn all that it takes to run a sophisticated dental business. So, you know, if the worst case scenario is that you're going to be making $250,000 to $400,000 as an associate, that's not a bad life. That's not a bad default at all. But us crazy people that are gluttons for punishment and we want to expose ourselves to the risk and extra stress of being multiple practice owners, that takes a special skill set and a lot of patience and a lot of lean years in addition to that, because you can't do both simultaneously. It's almost like you can't take your foot off. You have to take your foot off first, you know, if you're going to get to second base. And you can't be a 6 day a week, 5 day a week, 4 day a week hardcore clinician and still run like a very, very sophisticated business. That takes a lot more bandwidth than that. I'm going to throw some terms at you here. You can write them down if you need to, or you probably have a really good memory. So here's just a few terms. I'm going to ask you to rate these terms in order of complexity or levels of stress as a multiple practice owner. Okay, you ready?
Let's do it.
Okay, the first one is HR.
Okay.
Next is cash flow.
Okay.
Next is patient care or quality control.
Okay.
Next is operations, and then leadership.
Leadership.
Where have you found to be the biggest source of stress and the most difficult to wrap your head around and master?
I would say HR is definitely the toughest. So that's an easy one for me. And I think many people say that, you know, the hardest part is dealing with a team, dealing with employees. And I feel like we've built some really great teams, but there's still issues that come up all the time. So, you know, you're trying to play referee, you're trying to make everybody happy. You know, you have great team members that leave for other opportunities. We have, one of our amazing treatment coordinators, is moving on to bigger and better things. And we're very excited for her, but at the same time, it's tough when you invest time training, you know, a team member that's been a integral part of your office that, you know, that you're going to have to replace at that point. So that would be definitely my biggest source of stress for sure. It has helped finding some great office managers that can take things off my plate, but you're still never 100%. At least I have not found myself to be 100% removed from that. Even with some great office managers in place. So I would say that's probably the toughest. Let me think. After that, I would say cash flow probably was, it's gotten a lot better. So when I first opened my first office, and even when we first added the second one, I just had a local CPA that was kind of doing our books, and he was a nice guy, but honestly, I think I was paying him like a case of beer a month. So it wasn't, you know, anything crazy that he was doing. You know, you get what you pay for sometimes. And so here I was thinking I was saving money. I don't think he was doing everything correctly. He wasn't providing me with, you know, financials up to date. I didn't really have a look into my practice where I could be proactive. Everything was reactive. Mm-hmm. And I actually had something come up that was an oh shit moment. And I apologize if I can't say that on your podcast, but we had this where the implant office, I didn't realize exactly what our lab costs were associated. And so we had, I think, underpriced some of our full arch cases, trying to bring in as much business as possible as we were a new office. I thought our lab costs were $3,000 to $4,000 a case. Turns out they were like $6,500 a case. And the problem is you do the surgery and all the money comes in, we pre-collected for it. And then 6 months later, after healing, we're getting all these lab bills. So we had our first year where we thought we were more profitable than we were. My partner and I took some nice profit share. And then a few months later, all of a sudden we had these lab bills coming in, surgery slowed down. We kind of hit a slow point and the bank account dropped like $90,000 in the course of like 2 weeks. And I thought I was going to have to inject some cash into this business. So at that point in time, cash flow was very challenging and, you know, almost caused some issues for us. Since then I signed on with a more professional, larger CPA firm. And so I have, you know, meetings every 2 weeks with them. We go over our numbers. They're giving me looks into, you know, current cash flow projections so that I can be more proactive and make sure that we don't run into any of these issues anymore. Patient experience. I think it's tough as you get larger to try to copy and paste that, because I mean, that's been huge for us. We have over 1500 Google reviews at my flagship office. So, you know, obviously that was a big part of our growth. So that's been part of the thought process, is how do we continue to carry that over, especially at these new offices that are almost an hour away that I'm not personally going to be at. So, I guess I don't have a definitive answer for that yet, because we haven't really scaled to the point where I can see if it's going to be an issue, but I can imagine there's going to be some challenges associated with that as well. What were the other two terms?
Operations and leadership.
Operations and leadership. Leadership can be a struggle for sure. I mean, everyone expects you to be on your A game all the time. You know, you've got to lead by example, no matter all the different stresses going on, you know, in your day, in your week, you've got to show up to the office and you've got to, be the leader that your team really needs of you. And there are definitely days where there's so much going on that it's a challenge. You know, you're sitting there, kind of like they talk about at Disney World, you know, you're putting on a performance. But I think we do that for our teams. We do that for our patients as well. I think listening to podcasts, reading books, you know, being a member of a mastermind group like DSI has definitely helped me, but that's something that I'm constantly striving to, you know, improve on as a leader. Cause I know I'm not perfect at that yet. And then operations. Yeah, that's kind of one of those issues where I think I'm still wearing a lot of the hats. And I think as we continue to grow, I'm going to have to bring on other team members that I can, you know, push some more things onto their plate, because I basically am still, you know, CEO, operations manager, running payroll, paying bills, you know, all those types of things. So that is a challenge. It hasn't been too bad at four practices, but I can imagine, or at two practices, I can imagine at four practices, it's going to be even more challenging here in the coming months. And as we get to six, you know, at that point, I'm going to run out of bandwidth at some point for sure. So
for sure. I think right now you're at the tipping point. My kind of tipping point was between four and five. And that's when I was able to kind of justify assembling that C-suite, because you can split a large salary amongst a number of different entities, yep, depending on the amount of hours that they're spending per entity. So like your flagship practice would probably garner the most attention with, you know, 60% of the hours. So 60% of this, you know, $200,000 potentially salary would come from the flagship office, and then on down the line, depending on the percentage of time spent in each one. And until you hit that kind of four to five threshold with a minimum of $1 million per practice, you know, on average or whatever, it's very difficult to justify $150,000 to $200,000 salary. But if you select the right executive level team, even if it's just a regional manager instead of a COO that's making maybe $95,000 to $100,000, that is when everything starts to really click. If you hire the right team, and if you have correct onboarding and correct indoctrination into your culture, and all of the practices are being kind of run the same way, there's consistency amongst the locations, I think that's when things get really, really nice for the owner. And as you get more complex and as you add practices up to another breaking point or trajectory moment, that executive level or C-suite level team is going to decrease the stress and number of hours that you're working up until a certain point. So it's like, I think for me personally, so this isn't the same for everybody, but for me, the tipping point was four to five. And then from five to 10 was really nice. And then after 10, I had to structure things even more differently with regional managers and not just office managers and the COO. After that tipping point, if you hire correctly, life gets a lot better than it was for the first four. That was my experience anyway.
Did you look within dental for these executive positions, or did you hire outside dental from other industries?
You know, I've done it both ways. I've hired executive level people that were in dentistry and out of dentistry, and all the way on down from regional managers to office managers to, you know, treatment coordinators and every admin position I've hired for dental and non-dental. I have to tell you that for me, people that had at least a base level office manager type experience, in addition to business experience, were better executives in my organization. Now, my coaching and consulting group, none of the people that I hired in the executive level area are have dental experience, and that's okay. But for me, it was always easier if somebody spoke the language and understand the inner workings of, you know, front office, back office, you know, how difficult the hygiene department can be under certain circumstances, et cetera. That was just internal knowledge that was very, very valuable. So, yeah, this isn't a coaching call.
Dental's a big learning curve for sure. So
yeah, it's a huge learning curve. It's a huge learning curve. So I'm gonna go back to Matt here just for a little bit. Matt, tell me about, like, of the clients that you represent. I'm sure that you have lots of different types of dental practices. Like Dr. Vallo, for instance, has two strikingly different models. He's got a general model where he's working with, you know, an entire family. And then he has, you know, an implant type practice, which is much more surgically kind of focused. Tell me about, like, kind of the differences that you personally see in an approach to attracting patients for different types of practices, different models, potentially maybe a family-based office versus a boutique practice versus like a specialty type practice. How does your mind work as far as what bait and what media are you using for these different types of practices?
We try to look at everything from like the patient behavioral point of view first. I think one thing that we have as an advantage to us as being from outside of dental, we're not like a marketing firm and a solutions firm who was founded by a dentist that was solving a problem. We had no knowledge. So we kind of started with our shoes in the patient shoes from the beginning because they're the easiest for us to understand. And really a couple things that we're seeing is I'm going to answer the question is patient behaviors are changing today as rapidly as social media platforms are. And I think there's a lot of very old knowledge thinking in dental of like, I need to look for my ideal patient. Paid consults are better than free consults. There's some really like hard and fast rules people use to apply to things, which I think are really dangerous. And then a lot of times people don't realize their practice based on their treatment style, as far as like their makeup of abilities that they deploy in that practice, changes the behaviors of those consumers coming towards you greatly. And a lot of times when we analyze it, the first thing we look at is from click all the way to collections, can the patient do everything they need done in one location without having to go to other locations? So for an example, if we don't work with oral surgeons, we don't, because they can't restore their work, right? So in that scenario, the patient comes there, they get a quote for the placement of the implants, whatever it might be, and then they have to get referred back to someone else to get restored. We're finding consumers today, and oral surgeons are starting to feel this, I believe. They don't care if it's an oral surgeon or not. They want to go to one location and have convenience to get everything done in one place. The consumer definitely wants that. And in today's world, we're in a world today of like instant gratification to the max. Listen, my fat butt can sit on my couch and I can order bananas from Walmart and have them at my front door in 2 hours. We used to have a belief in dental that like, picking a dentist was this giant research project someone did. I feel that today it's this simple. It's they Google or look for or seek you out. And the first thing is, how close are you to my home or my place of business? You know, my accessibility. Second is, how good are your reviews? Next is, do you offer the service that I'm actually looking for? Now it becomes, will you give me a free consult or a paid consult? Right. And a lot of times I find specialty practices, like, so let's say I have a lot of practices that are super practices like Andrew's, where they do like a lot of arch work, like his one practice. And they say, well, you know, my arch work is worth this much. I'm so awesome. I want paid consults because I want that level of person. What we find is that consumer is contacting a few practices in the area that do the specialty they're looking for. And if even one will give them the opportunity of a free consult, they won't pay to go on a first date with someone else. They don't perceive that like payment as value. I think specialists in particular, where docs doing specialties they've invested a lot in, you know, CBCT, a mill, went and did an implant course and like, I'm going to be a full arch practice. They feel like that automatically allows them the ability to say, you have to have a paid consult to come meet me. What we're finding on our side is that the consumer behavior does not dictate that. Now, when you go down to the GP level, where it's like a GP practice, we kind of break practices into two groups: an arch practice, where your whole life is implants and arches, right? And then what we call an arch capable or implant capable practice. Today, every practice as GP is going towards implants. It's like crowns and CEREC machines years ago. It's just, that's the thing now. And with those practices, they're trying to capture the patient for all their dental needs. And that's much more relationship based. And that decision is definitely heavily based on the first thing the consumer thinks about is proximity of convenience to access that person. And a lot of times, one of their deciding factors is going to be how quickly can you get me in? I will tell you this, in the GP area where you might do some specialties, you have to get that patient in for their first meeting with you inside of 7 days when they contact you. That because think about it, in today's instant gratification world, they're like, hey, I can get something from my phone to my door in hours and not have to leave my home. If they call you and they're like, yeah, we can see you next Thursday, like, well, I'm sure I can call somebody and have them see me in the next 2 days. And they might book that appointment. And then they'll call someone else that's close to them and get in, and they'll forget about that appointment and no-show it, right? So like I think there's a lot of varying there. And I think that the consumer behaviors are changing so rapidly because social media is training us now. Like a lot of times, especially high-end boutique specialty practices have a concept they like to reference when I meet with them called their ideal patient. It's pretty common in dental. They're like, my ideal patient is X. And we go through the talk with them. And I'm like, what if I told you that that's not real? And like, well, what do you mean? Well, let's take this from the patient's consumer point of view. The entire social media ecosystem that we access from our phones, that is the centerpiece of our life, is designed for the patient to pick the ideal dentist. Everything digitally in our world now is designed for the consumer to find the ideal product or service. Now, when we have one person that's searching for their ideal, then the other person is saying, this is only my ideal. What happens is we have a real strangle on traffic. So I believe in dental, and this is an adapting issue that the high-end practices are having, is I think it's more important that the patient finds their ideal dentist and service than it is the dentist finds the ideal patient. And if you really think about it, this is gonna, I'm gonna catch flack. It's actually a selfish concept to say that my ideal patient is this. It's only what fits in this box. Because you're really saying that all I'm willing to deal with is this. But what if for one of the people that don't fit in your box, when they meet you in the operatory, you're the ideal dentist that gets them over dental anxiety? Like, I don't want to deny someone that experience, right? So if we look at the digital ecosystem where it's designed for me as a consumer to find where I want to invest my money for a service, it kind of counterworks against the concept of an ideal patient. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, totally. Totally. What have you found as far as how long it takes? I'm sure this varies, but on average, how long it takes to get traction from somebody that has never had a professional agency working with them, to start seeing some effective
Results.
results in their new patient flow?
So we like to define results to energize. So we hyper focus on return on investment. If you give me $5 back, my job is to give you $20 back. That takes 90 days from when the patient met you, depending on treatment styles and insurance pay schedules, all kinds of stuff, right? What docs are really saying when they ask, you know, how long to see results is they're saying, how long do I until I know the marketing's working? How long until I know that you're booking appointments for me? This is going to sound bizarre and nuts, and no one's going to believe it. We launch practices and we book their appointments and do everything for them until they're in the chair within hours of us turning on their social media account, within hours, whether a startup or mature practice, within hours of us turning on their social media account and us working with it, within hours, we're booking appointments. We launched a practice just recently in Texas, and we launched on a Friday. And by Monday, they had 40 new patient appointments booked. Now, that's an outlier. But our system is very quick to push to booking appointments and getting people in your chair. What takes time is how long does it take to get the return on investment? So really typical timeline, we track everything to the moment of investment. So January 15th, patient clicks on an ad. They come in, you know, a week later for the first free consult. They schedule work for the first week in February. Let's say it's an implant you're placing. That's 6 to 8 months with healing. It could be shorter if you have a Penguin or some kind of device to track healing. Let's say it's 6 months. What I just described from moment of investment in ads to collections and completing a phasing of treatment is about 9 months. Now, sometimes you get the money paid up front. There's different varying scenarios, right? But that new patient horizon, a lot of times docs only think about it from chair to collections, right? We have to think about it from when you got the patient. And what we've discovered is patients decide when they seek dental treatment based on life events in their world. So Like a good example of this is I watch a Super Bowl commercial for the new Corvette, but then in July I go shopping for a new Corvette because my lease is up, right? Well, it was Super Bowl marketing that brought me in July. And we have a way of tracking that. We have a way of tracking, like, what ad did you touch? And then when did you actually pay us in your collections? And when were you in the chair? And sometimes with some of the larger treatment styles, the patient will put in the request 8 months before they become collections. Like, we'll have their contact info and had communication with them sometimes 8 months before their collections.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. And we have the data, the kind of the data arc to track that. And what's really interesting is we're DI's largest marketing partner, and we kind of exchange information with them and share data. The top 1% of DI practices out of the 6,000 they have a new patient growth rate of 40%. The energized population's new patient growth rate is 268%. So we beat the top 1% of DI practices for new patient growth by multiple X's. And our data tracking is really next to none. It's pretty amazing.
Cool. Yeah. For me, tracking is one of the most important things. It's interesting how many marketing companies just neglect to do that. And I think that's one of the most important things is to be able to calculate that ROI, kind of like you were explaining. All right, boys, we're running out of time. Just in the last couple minutes, I'm going to ask the same question to both of you. What have you guys learned since becoming a new podcast, a new dental podcast? I believe there's like probably over 150 of them now. There was four when I started mine in June of 2015. So a lot has changed in the last 8 years. What have you guys learned as podcasters, and what is your vision for the show? I'll start with you, Dr. Vallo, first, and then I'll go to Matt.
Yeah, I learned that I don't know a whole lot about technology. So we've been trying to work through some of our microphone issues. We've had some issues with recordings not uploading. So we've had to re-record episodes a few times. It's a little bit more work than I think I anticipated going into it, but it's been fun at the same time. I've gotten to meet a number of dentists that I probably otherwise wouldn't have met. I've been on a few other podcasts as guests since we've launched this as well. So it's been kind of cool to work with other podcasts within the industry. We're actually going to be attending the Dental Podfest in Orlando in January. So we're looking forward to meeting some more dentists at that as well. Did the Voice of Dentistry, is that not doing that this year?
Nope, we're not doing it this year. We may
Okay.
have a reunion tour at some point in the future, but it ran its course. I think we did 6 years in a row, and we're just very, very busy guys, and
I
we
get it,
loved
man.
it. We really loved it, and it was a labor of love the entire time. And I met so many amazing people, but we're just going to take a little bit of a break for now.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Cool.
So, yeah,
And
that was about it for me. Yeah.
Matt, same question to you. What have you learned, and what's your vision?
Probably the same thing Andrew said. Both of us aren't technology people. So we decided to do a podcast, I guess, about a year ago now. We started working on it, and I started researching podcast equipment, started buying it, and we didn't really know what we were doing, honestly. And we kind of like always made a priority of like purity of like legitimate, helpful content over anything else, right? And I think the vision for us now is like, we want to keep that going and be able to have the power to select our guests based on the benefit we feel they bring to the audience, not how much money they're paying us for a product placement or a review of their products or a logo on the screen. And I really enjoyed it is like Andrew, like I've had dentists come out of the woodwork and like email me and contact me. And I was in a hotel at a dental event recently and somebody's like, "Oh, you're Matt Brown, listen to your podcast." And I was like, "Oh, do you like it?" And for me, what I've learned is like, I think the genuineness of us doing it with the spirit of it's not an infomercial for someone else's product. We don't even talk about my own product on there. I think people really resonate with like, I feel like you guys are both being selfless in the things you're saying, and it's being done from the motivation of you really want to just put out quality information for us. And the feedback of that has been really rewarding for me, and learning that that has actually gotten some pretty good equity in the marketplace with people being like, yeah, I value that. I am amazed by how much people really resonate with that being cool.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Well, you guys are doing a great job. Congratulations to both of you on the new show. Andrew, so glad to have you on the show and to have you inside DSI to rub shoulders with you on the regular and around some of our other awesome black belt coaches and our incredible community. So it's great to have you. I will ask Matt, I'll start with you. Is there any contact information that you'd like to share with the audience if people are interested in working with you from a marketing perspective?
Yeah, really easy. Just email me. It's Matt, M-A-T-T, at energize-group.com. Check my emails every day. You can get to me pretty easily. If you want to have a meeting and just talk on video, I'll make time for you. I love to talk to Dennis all the time.
Awesome. And Dr. Ballo.
Yeah, I mean, as our group grows, we're always looking for associate dentists. So I know there's a lot of dentists listening to this. You know, if our model sounds interesting to you, if you love placing and restoring full arch implants, or if you just love doing a bunch of Invisalign and cosmetic dentistry, you like palm trees, you like beaches, then Tampa could be a place for you. So feel free to send me an email. It's docvallo@gmail.com. You can also check out my Instagram. It's just dr.andrewvallo. So.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, fellas, thank you guys so much for returning the favor and coming on my podcast. It was great to have you both. I look forward to meeting you, Matt, in person someday. And Andrew, I'll see you soon enough at one of our DSI events. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Andrew Vallo and Matt Brown.